Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 231, and it's April 9th, our first meeting after spring break. Congratulations, y'all survived spring break. That's really good. I don't know what y'all did, but hopefully studied just a little bit, because here we see spring break on our schedule. We're going to talk some more about nervous system, probably peripheral nervous system. Probably won't get to autonomic nervous system today, but what we will get to on Wednesday is exam number 3, okay, which is 10, 11, 12, and 17. 17 is that endocrine chapter. All right, so next time make sure you have a picture ID, Scantron that's nice and clean, that's not mutilated, right, pencil, and a good eraser, because we're getting to the point in the class where if the Scantron reads your answer wrong because you have a stray mark on the Scantron, I will not give you credit for it, right? Or if you don't bubble it in, I won't give you credit for it. So make sure you have a good eraser. Because on a board exam, guess what? You would just be missing those points. And it might be enough points to where you have to take the board exam once again, and that's going to cost you hundreds of dollars, right? So just make sure you know how to fill out a Scantron properly. Okay, and with a good eraser. All right, so are there any questions? Does anybody have any questions regarding the test or anything that we've covered so far? Yes, I have a question. Oh, that we're in Blackboard?
Yeah,
website. I probably don't want to take time during lecture to take a look at that, but maybe right after lecture, let's take a look at Blackboard or the McGraw-Hill website and just see. Okay, usually they're around. Usually they're a flash file. So if you're using like an iPhone or something, they might not show up, but we'll look into it into some detail. All right, so we're done with the schedule. We'll put that away, and let's look at, we're going to finish up central nervous system. Last time we were looking at, like when we stopped talking, about the spinal cord, and we're going to cover spinal cord again today in lab, so it's a good idea to make sure that you know a nice cross-section of spinal cord. All right, so here's a nice transverse section of the spinal cord, and I can see gray matter and white matter very easily. Gray matter is dark, and I don't know, what is that, green or brown or dark beige or something like that? Okay. It's in that color family, so this is gray matter, because it's darker. And what the heck is gray matter? Once again, what is gray matter? It's a part of a neuron, is what I'm thinking of. It's a certain part of a neuron. It's a cell body and dendrites. And cell bodies and dendrites are never myelinated, right? And so they look gray, even to the naked eye. You don't need a microscope to see that. And then over here we see white matter, and I hope it kind of looks a little white. Certainly it's a lot lighter. And what part of a neuron do we find in white matter? Axons, right? Not nerve cell bodies and dendrites, but axons that are taking action potentials, nerve impulses, either up to the brain, right? And what do we call those kinds of pathways that take signals up to the brain? Sensory or afferent pathways, or they could be tracts that are taking signals from the brain out to the periphery, down the spinal cord, and what do we call those tracts? Those are efferent or motor tracts. Right? Furthermore, you should be able to identify or characterize motor tracts into either voluntary or involuntary. Right? And what's the effector organ for voluntary neurons? Skeletal muscle. What about involuntary? What are the effector organs for involuntary? Would be the cardiac muscle. That would be an involuntary effector organ. Glands and smooth muscle, right? And those would all be connected to motor tracts or descending tracts in the spinal cord. All right, so we have a gray commissural pathway. Come on, cursor, gray. Commissural pathway right here. Remember, commissural pathway connects right and left sides of the central nervous system, but it's gray matter, and right in the very center is the central canal that contains cerebral spinal fluid. And then the rest of the gray matter is broken down into some horns. So here's the dorsal horn, here's the anterior horn or ventral horn, and here's a lateral horn. Lateral horns we have in the thoracolumbar region only in particular. And then the white matter right here are the various kinds of tracts, either afferent or efferent tracts. And these are what? Myelinated axons, so these look white. So a column or a funiculus is the same thing, and a funiculus is just a derivation from a little term that we learned before called fascicle. Remember, muscles had different fascicles or bundles? There are different bundles in the spinal cord for either afferent or efferent signals. And they're arranged pretty much like your brain is arranged, the different lobes of your brain. So if you were to think of your brain, the frontal lobe, is that going to be more for motor activity or for sensory activity? Okay? Think of your car. What do you have in the front of your car? You have the motor, right? So the frontal cortex is what we call the motor cortex, especially that precentral gyrus is the primary motor cortex. So in the anterior parts of the spinal cord, these are mostly used for descending tracts. The ones in the posterior are mostly ascending or sensory, because where do you have sensory appreciation in your cerebral hemispheres? Anterior or posterior? For instance, occipital lobe is for vision, that's posterior. Parietal lobe, right, for sensation on the surface of your body. So there are more posterior compared to the frontal lobe. So the spinal cord is arranged pretty much the same way, though there are a lot of exceptions to that general rule. All right, neurons can enter or leave the spinal cord via roots, right? And then the roots exit the intervertebral foramen between the various vertebrae, and they're numbered pretty much just after the vertebrae that they go between to get out to the periphery. And then the anterior or ventral root, I see right here, the dorsal root is back over here, and there's a bulge in the dorsal root, and that contains all the nerve cell bodies of those pseudo-unipolar neurons, right, which are sensory or afferent neurons bringing information into the central nervous system. So here's the dorsal root, here's the ventral root, dorsal root ganglia, and then the two roots come together to form the spinal nerve. So the spinal nerve, what kind of activity is carried by this spinal nerve? Is it afferent or efferent, or is it mixed? Mixed meaning that it could be both. So that you would want to know. Another question, the ventral root right here. Remember, neurons can only carry information one way. So is this carrying afferent information or efferent information? And then the last question is, here's the dorsal root. What kind of information is this carrying? Afferent or mixed? So you should ask yourself those three questions, right, for these three structures. And let's make sure that you understand how that goes right now. So the dorsal root is what? 100% afferent, sensory. So signals are entering the central nervous system. The ventral root right here is 100% motor. Signals are leaving, right? So these are like two one-way streets, and this is like a little boulevard right here where there's no traffic whatsoever. And then the boulevard ends, and these two roots come together to form the spinal nerve. So what kind of traffic does a spinal nerve carry? Is it afferent or efferent or mixed? It's mixed because it contains neurons from both the dorsal and ventral roots. Okay. All right, the other thing that I see on this diagram, I see some membranes around the central nervous system, and that collection of membranes, and there are three of them, are what we call the meninges. So here are the meninges. Okay, the one that's right on the surface of the spinal cord and follows every little nook and cranny, every little convolution and bend and dip in the spinal cord, this is what we call the pia mater. It's a very delicate layer. It's thinner than tissue paper, right? But it does follow the contours of the spinal cord as well as the brain when we start looking at the brain. Then there's a membrane right in the middle, and this is what we call the arachnoid membrane. It's a little bit tougher than the pia mater, but it's still not the strongest layer of the meninges, which is the dura mater right here. Dura means durable. This is a tough layer, and it surrounds the brain and spinal cord and protects the brain and spinal cord from a lot of trauma. It holds it together. All right, so I see the three different membranes right here. Okay, so this probably is a pretty good exam figure. Does anybody know if this is an exam figure or not? Nobody knows. Uh-oh. When's the next test? Anybody know when the next test is? Oh, but it doesn't cover this chapter. Okay, whew. All right. I can relax a little bit. Okay. All right, so I'm sure this is an exam figure. So you got gray matter, white matter, you got horns and columns, you got roots, spinal nerve, okay, and roots then are composed of rootlets that you see right here, okay, but nerves can only leave through the intervertebral foramen between two vertebrae, so that's why rootlets have to converge together to form a spinal nerve. Okay, so let me put this picture back. Let's look at some examples of pathways. Oh, maybe we did take a look at this. I can't remember if we had or not. All right, so here is a good pathway. And, I graded your practicums. You're ready to look at. I'm just pretty surprised that a lot of the muscles had names and were named by their origin and insertion, and a lot of people missed. Okay, when they asked for the insertion or the origin of a muscle, then you got the name right, but you didn't know the origin and insertion. That was, you already gave me the answer in the previous line. Right, so that I was a little disappointed, sad to see that. Like the coracoid brachialis. What's the origin of the coracoid brachialis? The coracoid process, right? It's right in the name, right? So I know I've mentioned that a number of times. And the only reason why I mention it right now, okay, is not to point out to people that they missed some easy points, but nomenclature is pretty important. In terms, even in the way that we name spinal pathways. Okay, for instance, here's one called the spinal thalamic pathway. And I think you know now where the thalamus is. Where's the thalamus? Is that in the spinal cord or periphery or brain someplace? It's in the brain. All right, so here is a nice picture of a brain right here. And the thalamus is right here and right here. And here's the name, spinal thalamic. And again, this is telling you where signals originate and where they end up. Right? The first part of the word is where the signals originate, and the second part is where they end up. So where do they originate? In the spinal cord. Where do they end up? In the thalamus, in the brain. Yeah, right? So thalamus. So is this an afferent or an efferent pathway? Okay, are they going up to the brain or down to the periphery? Up to the brain because they originate in the spine and they go up to the thalamus, so this is an afferent pathway or a sensory pathway, not a motor pathway, right? And you can actually see some various stimuli right here. For instance, temperature receptors or pain receptors in the hand send these pain signals in, all right? And what root do they enter the spinal cord? The dorsal root. Here's that nice unipolar neuron right here, so they enter the spinal cord, go into the posterior gray horn where they synapse. Here's the first synapse. So this is the peripheral process of that pseudo-unipolar neuron. Here is the central process. Here is the second-order neuron, and it crosses over to the opposite side of the spinal cord through the gray commissure, and then it ascends right through the spinal thalamic tract, and it goes all the way up to the thalamus. And remember, the thalamus is a relay center, where it takes information from the periphery and then it ships it out to the proper part of the brain, according to that little homuncular diagram that we were looking at previously. Okay, and this right here is the primary somatosensory cortex. And which one is that? That's on one side of the central sulcus. What side of the central sulcus? Remember, this is sensory. Is this precentral gyrus or postcentral gyrus? This is going to be the postcentral gyrus because, remember, motor is in the precentral, sensory is in the postcentral gyrus. Motor is in the front of your car, for instance. That would be an easy way to remember it. So here is a third-order neuron. So how many neurons does it take to take information, a stimulus information from your foot all the way up to the cerebral cortex for your appreciation? I see one, I see two, I see three neurons, right? And they all have to synapse right here in the thalamus, which is gray matter because it has a bunch of nerve cell bodies right there, and I can see the little nerve cell bodies as those little dots. Okay, so if you look at your little homuncular diagram, okay, then you would see this would be the area for the hand, this would be the area for the foot right there. So if we were to then just electrically stimulate these parts of the brain, like this one right here, what would you have? What would happen? If we were to stimulate this part of the cerebral cortex, which would be the primary somatosensory cortex or the post-central gyrus, what would happen? Would some part of your body move? Okay. Somatosensory, sensory is what? A feeling. So if we were to stimulate this part of your brain right here, you'd have a feeling, you'd have a sensation where? Way down at your foot. If we were to stimulate this area of your brain, the post-central gyrus, or the somatosensory cortex, you would have a feeling where? On your hand someplace. Right? So the surface of the brain maps to the surface of your body according to that little homuncular diagram that we looked at previously. All right, so all sensory information synapses in the thalamus before it's directed to the proper part of the cerebral cortex for your appreciation of whatever that stimulus is. All right, and that's what we call the spinothalamic pathway. So spinothalamic is what, motor or sensory pathway? Yeah, sensory. What's another name for sensory? Afferent. That's a nice afferent pathway. All right, so that's one pathway that I want you to know. What is another one? Cortical spinal tract. All right, what can you tell me about cortical spinal tract before I even pull it up right here? I'm going to go find it. But what about the cortical spinal tract? Tell me a lot about it already. What kind of tract is it? What kind of tract? Afferent or efferent? Remember, the name tells you where the signals originate and where they end up. Where do they start from? The cortex, the cerebral cortex. And where do they end up? Spinal cord. So is that an afferent or efferent pathway? That's a nice motor or efferent pathway. Yeah, let's take a look at it. So here we see it right here. All right, so now we're at the primary motor cortex. What lobe of the brain is the primary motor cortex in? Where do you have the motor in your car? Frontal lobe, so that's the precentral gyrus in particular. All right, and when these neurons depolarize, there's a cell body. It goes down. So here's a long axon, and it's myelinated. What kind of brain matter contains myelinated axons? White matter. Does that look like white matter right there? Indeed it does. There's white matter between the thalamus and the basal nuclei. We call this the internal capsule. It is taking a bunch of efferent tracts down to the spinal cord. Okay, down through the pons and the medulla, finally into the spinal cord. Right, so that's all one neuron that goes all the way down to the spinal cord where it synapses on an interneuron in the gray matter, and then it leaves the spinal cord with a third motor neuron. Okay, and what do you call this neuronal tissue right here? This is a motor, this is 100% motor pathway. This is the ventral root leaving the spinal cord. And then it joins the spinal nerve. That spinal nerve takes it to some skeletal muscle someplace, causing that skeletal muscle to contract. All right, so if we were to stimulate this part of the brain, would you feel something or would some part of your body move? Some part of your body would move because this is the primary motor cortex or the precentral gyrus. All right, and so here is a nice cortical spinal tract right here. So this is an exam figure as well. Okay, so there is an example of a sensory pathway, spinothalamic tract, and a motor pathway, the cortical spinal tract. Okay, reflexes. Oh, I think we talked about reflexes a couple of times before. Okay, and a reflex arc. I don't have this on your diagram or the list, your text list right here, but so you got to modify this text. Right? What does a reflex arc always start with? What does it always start with? You have a sensory receptor, number one position on your list. But that should be updated by you. What should be in the number one position? You should put it right up over here. Yeah, a stimulus. You could say signal, but a stimulus probably is a better way of talking about it. Right? What is sensitive to a stimulus? A receptor, right. So light could be a stimulus, but in order for light to be a stimulus, what does your body have to have? Photoreceptors, for instance, in your eye. All right, and maybe the stimulus is an ice cube. What would you need? What kind of receptor? A temperature receptor for you to feel cold, right? Or if you picked up a hot pan, you need another thermal receptor for hot temperature, right? So stimulus comes first, right? And then a receptor can sense that stimulus, and then it sends a signal to the central nervous system via what, an afferent neuron? How does an afferent neuron enter the central nervous system? The things are what? Roots in the spinal cord, and that's going to be a dorsal root, which is 100% sensory. And then there's an association neuron, which can make sense of that signal. Maybe it wants to share that information with different parts of the brain. And it then sends information back out the ventral root, because that's motor, to an effector organ via a motor neuron. And then the last thing you have to fill in right here, what does an effector organ do for you? What does a reflex arc or response loop always end with? And the correct answer was a response, right? So you don't forget, put in stimulus. Reflex arc always starts with a stimulus and it always ends with a response. So a good question is, what produces a response in your body? It's on the list right here. What can produce a response in your body? So here is just a list of different structures, how they relate to each other. What's right above a response? The effector organ. Yeah, so effector organ always produces a response, right? So a motor neuron doesn't directly produce a response, but an effector organ produces a response. Okay. All right, so here are the meninges that we were talking about. All right, it's connective tissue layers that surround the brain and the spinal cord. Here are the three layers, the dura mater, the arachnoid, and the pia mater. And it protects the brain. Let me get a nice picture of the meninges. Here's a great picture, and here it is for you to see. All right, so here is a skull with a brain still on the inside, and I see a nice coronal section through the brain. So here's a longitudinal fissure. I can see gray matter and white matter. Remember gray matter? Here's some gray matter. That's nerve cell bodies and dendrites. And then these are myelinated axons going someplace. Here's that longitudinal fissure. And just like on the spinal cord, the outermost layer right here is what we call the dura mater. In lab, those of you that had lab this morning, what can you tell me about the dura mater? Tough. It's a pain to dissect because it's so tough, right? Unless you have a really sharp scalpel. Okay, and the dura mater has a couple different layers. The layer that's closest to a bone, right, that's what we call the periosteal part of the dura mater. And then there's another division that's closer to the brain, that's deeper. We call that the meningeal layer of the dura mater. These two form a single structure that's really, really tough. It's almost as tough as shoe leather, but not quite as thick. Really protects the brain. Okay, the next layer we have right here is the arachnoid. It's right up against the dura mater. It's right next to it. Okay, and then we have a space underneath the arachnoid membrane that's filled with fluid, and you can kind of guess what's the name of this fluid right here. It's made by a choroid plexus. What kind of fluid is made by a choroid plexus? Cerebrospinal fluid, right? So the brain is actually floating in this fluid because this space, which is right below the arachnoid membrane, right, is called the subarachnoid space, filled with cerebrospinal fluid. So that helps float the brain. It suspends the brain. Because if you were to weigh yourself on land and then weigh yourself in a pool, where would you weigh less? In a swimming pool, right? Because the water would help buoy you up a little bit. Okay, so that helps suspend the brain. And then there's another layer which is very delicate that follows every contour, every gyrus and sulcus on the surface of the brain, and that's what we call the pia mater right here. So those are the three layers, the pia mater, the arachnoid, and the dura mater, both the periosteal and meningeal part of the dura mater. All right, so I see some blood vessels between the arachnoid and the pia. You'll see that in lab, and some of these veins are kind of elongated. They fill up a sulcus. All right, but there are some very large veins in the brain that drain blood back to the heart. And I see one right here. This is what we call the superior sagittal sinus. So a sinus is just a big space that can be filled with air if it's a paranasal sinus. But a sinus in the brain right here, like the superior sagittal sinus, is draining blood from the brain back to the heart so the heart can pump it to the lungs so it can be reoxygenated so it can get pumped back to the brain again to give up oxygen. So here's the superior sagittal sinus. And what plane is this found in exactly? The mid-sagittal plane, right? So, and it's right above the brain, so superior sagittal sinus is a nice easy name to remember. Okay, so the choroid plexus makes cerebrospinal fluid that's in the subarachnoid space, right? And if the choroid plexus makes a lot of fluid, that would compress the brain because the subarachnoid space would get bigger and bigger and bigger. But here is something that returns that fluid that actually came from the blood, it returns it back to the blood. And I see an arachnoid villus. Sometimes we call it an arachnoid granulation. This allows for fluid or cerebrospinal fluid that's in the subarachnoid space to drain back into the cardiovascular system so that you don't become dehydrated. And it also maintains the shape of the brain so the brain doesn't get compressed, for instance. Okay. This separation right here, the part of the dura mater in the longitudinal fissure, is what we call the falx cerebri. Right? It's just a little separation or a septum between the right and left cerebral hemispheres. Right? So the right and left cerebral hemispheres really don't communicate with each other through the falx cerebri, but the right and left sides of the brain do know what each is thinking. How do signals get from the right to the left side of the brain? You guys didn't review over the break because it's not on the exam coming up. But what kind of pathway can share information from right to left? It's called a Kamishiro pathway. Okay, and in particular, there is an important structure in the brain that you're going to see in lab, and we looked at it last time, and that's called the corpus callosum. All right, let's look at that corpus callosum. So here's a longitudinal fissure, right? Here's a nice mid-sagittal section. Here is the corpus callosum right here, containing commissural pathways so that the right and left sides of the brain know what's going on. Okay, so this figure right here, definitely a good exam figure to know. And there's probably some interactive exercises in Blackboard as well. Okay, so here's that falx cerebri, the dura mater that's separating right and left hemispheres. There's also part of the dura mater when you do your dissections that you're going to see. This is the falx cerebelli, right, between the occipital lobe and the cerebellum down over here. And the tentorium in this region right here, separating the cerebellum from the cerebrum. And here is that superior sagittal sinus draining blood back down to the heart. All right, let's look at some ventricles inside the brain. Where the heck are these ventricles at? What do ventricles contain? What does ventricle mean? What does ventricle mean while I find these figures? A ventricle is just a chamber. And there are chambers inside the brain that don't contain neurons or neuroglia cells, but it contains fluid. And I see the chambers right here. So they're all kind of compressed. This is a three-dimensional picture that's just been compressed and all just from into a lateral view. There are chambers laterally in the cerebral hemispheres that I'm kind of outlining right now. These are what we call the lateral ventricles. They used to be called the ventricles 1 and 2, but now we just call them lateral ventricles. And it's filled with cerebrospinal fluid. Who can tell me what makes cerebrospinal fluid once again? Choroid plexus. I'm going to show you a picture of that. Fills up these chambers, and then that CSF, or cerebrospinal fluid, can flow into the third ventricle, which is a very thin ventricle right around the thalamus and hypothalamus, right in the inside of it. Here's the pathway between the lateral ventricle and the third ventricle. This is the interventricular foramen. And what's the function of a foramen once again? It's a passageway, and in this particular case, is it a passageway for a blood vessel, or for a nerve, or for a muscle, or what is passing through this passageway right here? Cerebrospinal fluid, yeah. Made by the choroid plexus, and it flows into the third ventricle. And here's the fourth ventricle between the pons and the cerebellum. Here's the fourth ventricle, and cerebrospinal fluid is made by choroid plexus in the roof of the third ventricle, not shown on this diagram, but it's right in this location. And then it's going to flow down through this canal, right through the part of the midbrain, and we call this the cerebral aqueduct, into the fourth ventricle. And then from the fourth ventricle, it can flow out via this median aperture or a lateral aperture, just a little foramen, or it can actually flow through the central canal to the very bottom of the spinal cord, where it exits, okay? And then where it ends up is in the subarachnoid space, and it flows all the way back up to the brain. The fluid leaving the median and lateral aperture flows through the subarachnoid space back up to the superior part of the brain where we have those arachnoid villi, and it's returned, that the cerebrospinal fluid is then returned to the blood, right, so that we don't dehydrate, or so that fluid doesn't build up inside the brain. If any of these apertures or foramen get blocked or occluded, right, then fluid will build up in the brain or spinal cord, and it could end up in a condition, what's that condition called? That looks like this. That is hydrocephalus, right? And unfortunately, this person right here will have a really short life. Now with good prenatal care, these things can be diagnosed very early before somebody's born, and then shunts can be placed in the brain, okay, to allow that cerebrospinal fluid to drain out of the ventricles, okay, it could be put into another ventricle or into a vein directly so that the neonate's brain can actually develop normally as a result of that. All right, so here is just a little bit different view of the ventricles. Here are the lateral ventricles. This is a nice anterior view, lateral ventricles. Here's that interventricular foramen. Here's the third cerebral aqueduct and the fourth. You can see the lateral apertures leading to the subarachnoid space. Then here's the central canal, which goes all the way down to the conus medullaris of the spinal cord. All right, so those are the ventricles. Here is a pretty nice picture of what a choroid plexus looks like. So here is a nice capillary right here, and this capillary is going to be leaking plasma out, and these cells, these ependymal cells, which is a kind of neuroglia cell, that could be on the test coming up on Wednesday, the ependymal cells produce cerebrospinal fluid, right? And that cerebrospinal fluid contains glucose. What good is glucose? What can your brain do with glucose? It can make ATP out of it, right? That's a nice energy source, right? And oxygen, oxygen leaves as well. Oxygen is important because that's necessary for mitochondria to make ATP from glucose. And the choroid plexus also adjusts various levels of vitamins and a number of different electrolytes like sodium and magnesium and iron and calcium, okay, to maintain the proper extracellular fluid of the brain. Because we don't want that to change. Because if that changes, the electrical properties of your brain changes. And then what might happen if the electrical properties of your brain changes? What might happen to you? Well, you could go into a coma, completely lose consciousness, or maybe you could have even seizure activity, right? Could be on either end of the spectrum if these electrolytes, oxygen, and important metabolites like glucose aren't maintained in the proper concentration. Okay? Nothing good will ever happen if these things aren't adjusted properly. Okay, so here's a nice microscopic illustration of what a choroid plexus looks like. All right, so what else do we need to look at? I think that's about it. Oh, but let's look at that flow pattern once again. I think we do have a pretty nice illustration of a flow pattern right here. All right, so what produces cerebral spinal fluid again? Choroid plexus in the lateral ventricles, in the roof of the third ventricle, in the floor of the fourth ventricle. Choroid plexus that makes cerebral spinal fluid. And then it flows from the lateral ventricles into the third via the interventricular foramen. From the third into the fourth via what? The cerebral aqueduct. And then from the fourth, it can leave via the lateral and median apertures into the subarachnoid space, or it can travel all the way down through the central canal to the bottom of the spinal cord, and then enter the subarachnoid space, and then it comes back up, right, to an arachnoid villus right here, which then it re-enters the venous supply or the venous drainage of the brain back into the cardiovascular system via the arachnoid villus. So fluid doesn't build up in the brain, and then you don't dehydrate either, right? And you can see the nice superior sagittal sinus right here. Okay, so that's an important flow of cerebrospinal fluid. Okay, and I think that's it for central nervous system. Probably one of the longer chapters in your book. Okay, that's not on the exam on Wednesday. Okay, so let's put that away and move on to our next chapter, which is going to be peripheral nervous system. So where is peripheral nervous system at? Here's peripheral nervous system. Let me get some nice pictures going for peripheral nervous system. And what chapter is peripheral nervous system? 14. Okay, first just looking at some functional organization. As a matter of fact, even on the test coming up, I gave you a flow diagram of how to organize a nervous system. Right, and one of the two main ways is by classifying something as being either sensory or motor. Right, and sensory does what? What does a sensory pathway do for you? It takes information from where to where? Sensory. From the periphery to the brain. Brings information in. Okay, and a motor pathway takes information where? From your brain or central nervous system back out to an effector organ. Okay, and so as far as sensory goes, we have somatic sensation, which is on the surface of your body, right? It's on your skin for temperature and vibration and things like that, right? And muscles of your body. Visceral is a sensation that's deep inside your body, and these sensations are quite a bit different. Right, it's really hard to describe their difference, but somatic sensation maybe is very acute and it's a kind of sensation that we're used to, so we're very familiar when we shake somebody's hand or we get poked with a needle or we burn ourselves, okay? But a visceral sensation is sort of a dull, aching sensation, maybe if you've had an appendicitis, right, or something wrong with your digestive tract, right, or reproductive tract. It doesn't mean that it's not as intense, it's just not quite as acute feeling. It's a duller pain, okay, or a kidney stone or something like that. But it's pain arising from organs that are in body cavities. Somatic sensation comes from the surface, not from body cavities. All right. Motor, on the other hand, can be broken down into somatic or visceral. Once again, somatic means it's going to a skeletal muscle, which means it's voluntary. All right. And then we have visceral. And another way of talking about visceral is that it's controlling effector organs that you don't have voluntary control over, which is what? Cardiac muscle, smooth muscle, and glands, for instance. For instance, if we all got up right now and ran up and down the stairs 20 or 30 times, what would happen to our body temperature? It would increase. Now, could you stop yourself from sweating? No, you don't have any voluntary control over that. That's controlled by your autonomic nervous system, right? So that would be visceral sensation. That would be glands. You don't really have control over glands. All right, so that's a functional organization. As far as a structural organization, right, we have peripheral sensory receptors, and sometimes we have peripheral motor endings going to skeletal muscles. So we have a couple different peripheral endings, either receptors or motor endings. And then we have different nerves that is going to carry information from the central nervous system to the periphery or vice versa. Cranial nerves arise from the brain. They come out of the brain, okay, and there's 12 pairs. Spinal nerves come from the, take a guess. What are the parts of your central nervous system? Brain and spinal cord, right? So cranial nerves come from the brain and spinal nerves come from the spinal cord, the other division of the central nervous system. All right, we got 12 pairs of cranial nerves and we've got 31 pairs of spinal nerves. The naming of spinal nerves is pretty easy, because they're named after the vertebrae that they exit the vertebral column next to. Okay, so if I say C3, what does that mean to you? That's the third cervical vertebrae, and there's going to be some nerves leaving between C3 and C4, right? And we're going to call that the origin of C3. Okay, cranial nerves are a little bit different. They have specific names, and they're just labeled from anterior to posterior 1 through 12. So the most anterior is going to be number 1. And just to give you a little hint, what is the most anterior sense organ on your head? Your most anterior one. Your nose. And that sense is what we call olfaction. And that leaves the brain, the most anterior part of your brain, that's cranial nerve number 1. Okay, the next most anterior are your eyes. That's the optic nerve. That's cranial nerve number 2. Okay, so when we look at a diagram, just kind of remember that little cheat sheet, and we'll just keep naming the nerves as we go more posterior. But before we get to cranial nerves, let's talk about some peripheral receptors. All right, so they pick up stimuli, and they send it to the brain via what? Afferent pathways, right? And we've got a couple kinds. There are free nerve endings, and then we have some that have special receptor cells associated with them. And I think you're kind of familiar with these things already, because remember the integument right here? Right, this is just a blast from the past. I see some free nerve endings right here. Free nerve endings are for temperature, for cold temperature, hot temperature, but also pain. If you cut any of these free nerve endings right here, then you'll experience pain. There are free nerve endings that innervate a hair follicle so that when a hair is jostled on the surface of your skin, you can feel that. Right, so these are just free nerve endings. And then other nerve endings are encapsulated, like these Pacinian corpuscles right here. And a Meissner's corpuscle up closer to the surface of the skin. So Pacinian is for deep pressure and vibration. Meissner's corpuscle are for light pressure. Right, and then these Merkel's discs are even for lighter pressure. And these Merkel's discs are actually up in the epidermis. They're not even in the dermis. So therefore, very, very light discriminative touch. And these are the things that can send stimulus for when somebody's trying to read Braille, for instance. You could actually read using these different receptors right here just by understanding the pattern of dots that are placed on a piece of paper. Okay, so these are for somatic sensation.
ooh, I want to get that, put that away altogether, but I want this one right here. Okay. So extroreceptors, we can classify receptors. Extroreceptors are for sensing stimuli on the outside of your body. Interoceptors are for sensing stimuli that is inside your body. So what are some things on the outside of your body? Touch, pressure, pain, temperature, right? And most special sense organs like vision, hearing, and taste, right? These are things that are outside your body. Interoceptors measure different kinds of temperature and maybe stretch inside your body and various kinds of chemicals. Right, they'll give you a sense of visceral pain, maybe nausea, hunger, fullness, thirstiness. Okay, and then here's a third class, proprioceptors. These are located all over your body in all different kinds of muscles and joints, and they send to the cerebellum what the tension is in various muscles and what the angulation of various joints are so that you know exactly what your body's doing without looking. Right, so those are pretty important. Okay, we can also classify receptors by the kind of stimulus that they are sensitive to. Mechanical receptors can sense touch, pressure, and vibration. Thermoreceptors can sense what kind of stimulus? Temperature, yeah, like hot and cold. Chemoreceptors can monitor things like what? Yeah, like chemicals, like in your olfactory, in your nose. They can sense various kind of odorant molecules. Right, or maybe they're interoceptors, they can measure the pH or the amount of acidity in your body. And there are receptors in the pancreas that can measure glucose concentration in the blood. Those would be chemoreceptors because glucose is a chemical. Where do you have photoreceptors? In your eyes, right. And nociceptors are just receptors that monitor any kind of damaging stimulus to your body, whether it's pressure or chemical stimulus. Like if I were to break open a capsule of ammonia and put it by your nose, even though you're sleeping, what would happen to you? You would wake up because it's a very noxious stimulus, right? It would be burning your nose a little bit, and you'd wake up and you'd probably exhale and shake your head to get those chemicals out of your body. Okay. Oh, we talked about these different kinds of receptors already. Encapsulated, non-encapsulated, proprioceptors. Okay, peripheral motor endings. Innervation of skeletal muscle. Well, let's see what we got. Wow, I don't know if I have that. I might have to go find that picture. Unless I included it right here. Let me go back. Can I do that? Oh my, where's muscle? What chapter was muscle? Let's look at 10 first. Okay, peripheral motor endings. Neuromuscular junction. So it's a junction between a neuron and a muscle fiber, right? Has a motor endplate. It's similar to a structure of a synapse, right? So here is a nice skeletal muscle right here. I don't know if this is on the test coming up. Maybe it is. Here is an axon. Here's an axon terminus or bouton terminale. And there's a little swelling right here because the little axon terminus contains a lot of synaptic vesicles, okay? And typically, what's contained within a synaptic vesicle? A general term for the compound that's inside these synaptic vesicles right here. It is neurotransmitter, okay? And one specific example of a neurotransmitter is acetylcholine. Acetylcholine is a neurotransmitter used at every neuromuscular junction, right? So neuron axon terminus via the muscle fiber right here. So This is the presynaptic cell. The muscle fiber is acting like the postsynaptic cell. When a nerve impulse reaches this axon terminus, calcium enters the cell. That calcium then causes the fusion of these synaptic vesicles to the presynaptic membrane, and it exocytoses neurotransmitter into the synaptic cleft. And since this is the neuromuscular junction, what's the name of this neurotransmitter that's being released from these synaptic vesicles? It is acetylcholine. Acetylcholine then diffuses over to the postsynaptic membrane, which is the sarcolemma on this muscle cell, where it's got to bind to something before it can cause excitation of the muscle. What does it have to bind to? It's not labeled on this diagram right here, but there are receptors, right, that bind acetylcholine, and that starts another electrical signal on the muscle fiber, okay, and that causes the muscle to contract, right? So this is what we call a nice chemical synapse, because there's an electrical signal in the neuron. It gets converted to a chemical signal through the synaptic cleft, right? And then that chemical signal gets converted to a nice electrical signal once again on the muscle cell, and that electrical signal then causes the sliding of these myofilaments, which you have to know something about for Wednesday, right? And again, the sliding of these filaments is controlled by calcium ions released from the sarcoplasmic reticulum right here. Here's the terminal cisternae of the sarcoplasmic reticulum. So these arrows represent electrical signals or action potentials, okay, going down through these transverse tubules causing release of calcium from the sarcoplasmic reticulum. And then it causes these filaments to slide over each other. Let's just review this real quick. What kind of filament does this look like right here? Looks blue to me. Is that blue? How would you talk about this one besides blue? It's a thin filament. What do we call a thin filament? Actin, right? And what about these right here? That's a thick filament. And what do we call a thick filament? Myosin, right? And which ones of these two actually shorten when a muscle contracts? Does actin get shorter or does myosin get shorter? You're shaking your head like, what is he talking about? Because neither of them shorten. What happens when a sarcomere contracts, when this Z line gets closer to the Z line right here? The actin and myosin don't get shorter. They do what? They slide over each other, right? Because there's cross bridges that pull them together like that. And there's some pretty cool videos in Blackboard to see that. Okay. So that is the neuromuscular junction. Okay, a motor unit, I think we talked about this already, is, okay, so here I see an axon going to this one muscle cell right here. So here's a muscle cell, but this axon can have branches that go to a number of muscle cells, in which case when a nerve impulse comes down that neuron, instead of one muscle cell contracting, maybe three will contract. Or maybe there are 20 or 50 branches, in which case, if there's an action potential coming down, 50 muscles will contract. All right, so which will produce a stronger contraction? One that has three muscles or ones that have maybe 50 muscle cells connected all together to one neuron? The strongest one is going to have more muscle fibers, so the 50 to 1. So that's what we call a motor unit. And a muscle will always contract to 100% of its ability. So if you have one neuron going to 50 muscles, that's going to produce a very strong contraction. Can't get any weaker. Those are used for postural muscles that we use in our back. All right. But for instance, we'll have motor units that have a smaller number of muscle fibers going to our face and to our hand, because when we grab, say, a peach, we don't want to grab it like we're grabbing a bowling ball or a battery or something, because what would happen to the peach? It would just squirt all over the place, right? So we have different kinds of motor units for different kinds of activities. Okay, visceral muscle in both cardiac and smooth muscle is involuntary. You don't have control of it. Again, for instance, if we were to run up and down the stairs 30 times, what would happen to our heart rate? It would be elevated, it would go way up, and could you get it back down to resting heart rate just by thinking about it in a second, as soon as you stopped exercising? No, you couldn't, because it's under autonomic control. Okay, the neurotransmitter is not acetylcholine, but it is norepinephrine that's being used. So norepinephrine is a neurotransmitter to autonomic effectors, and acetylcholine is the neurotransmitter for voluntary or skeletal muscles. Okay, cranial nerves. Let's look at some cranial nerves. Okay, sign-in sheet is going around someplace. Who's got the sign-in sheet? Is that back down on the front, back in the top? It's at the top, but it will come back down, so make sure you sign the sign-in sheet, because I forgot, since it's after spring break already. All right, so here we have the brain. We've got like frontal lobe, temporal lobe, cerebellum. Here's the medulla. Here's the pons. And in yellow, I see nerves leaving the brain. So are these cranial nerves or spinal nerves? Those got to be cranial nerves, right, because they're leaving the brain. And they're just numbered 1 through 12 from anterior to posterior. Like number 1 right here, cranial nerve number 1. That is for the sense of olfaction. Okay, cranial nerve number 2 is the optic nerve. And then cranial number 3, we're going to see this in lab, that's oculomotor. What do you think that one does? Is that for vision? Is that for sensation? Oculomotor. It's not sensation, it's motor or efferent. It does what? Moves your eyeballs around, okay? So that you can look up and down and medially, oculomotor nerve. Then, so that's 3, here's 4, trochlear. Here's 5, trigeminal. Then 6 is abducens. Okay, then we have a bunch right here. Facial is 7. Vestibulocochlear is number 8. Okay, and glossopharyngeal 9. And here's going to be one of your favorite nerves. Vagus nerve number 10. Okay, vagus nerve number 10. 11, accessory to the vagus nerve. It kind of reminded people of the vagus nerve. And then number 12 right here is hypoglossal nerve. So it's just 1 through 12 all the way down the line. But you do also have to know the names and a little bit of the function of some of these nerves. We went over some of the function. Like cranial nerve number 1 is for smell. Okay, and is that sensory or motor? Sensory, yeah, 100% sensory. Here is the optic nerve. Is that motor or sensory? Sensory, and as a matter of fact, it's 100% sensory. Here is oculomotor. And is this sensory or motor? I know it's cheating when they put it in the name, but just because it's in the name doesn't mean you still have to understand what that means, right? Just like origin and insertion. Don't forget that. All right, so you do have to know the names of all of these cranial nerves right here. And it's sort of a tedious list, right? So to help us remember, to help a lot of people remember, we like to use a mnemonic. And a mnemonic is just a little easy saying, okay? It's just it could be a poem or it could be a sentence. It could be a bunch of words that relate to each other. And if you take, here's the mnemonic right here. On old Olympus's towering top, a Finn and German viewed a hop. Okay, and some of you are laughing, which is good because that means maybe you know what that means. Okay, and some of you that have never been to Europe or are not very European-minded, this doesn't really have a lot of meaning. But what is this Olympus referring to? It's referring to a big mountain that's in Europe. Okay, Mount Olympus is a really big mountain. So on old, and it's a very old mountain. So that's where towering top comes from, right? Because it's a big mountain. A Finn. What's a Finn? It's a person, right? It's a person from Finland, okay? And German is a person from Germany, right? And they're sitting on Mount Olympus looking down into the valley. And I guess Finns and Germans like to drink a lot of beer, okay? And one of the grains that's necessary to make beer is called a hop, okay? Or hops, yeah. So that's what that saying means to me. But you can make up your own mnemonic if you wanted to. Your book has a couple. All right, so the way you use a mnemonic is that you take the first letter of the first word, and that's going to correspond to the first letter, the first word of the list that you're trying to remember. Like the O in on refers to the O in olfactory. The O in old refers to the O in optic. On down the line. So if you can remember this, on old Olympus's towering top, a Finn and German viewed a hop, then you've kind of memorized the correct order of cranial nerves from How many words are in this saying right here? There's 12, because how many cranial nerves are there? Exactly 12. All right, so here hop refers to what cranial nerve? Number 12, but in particular, you're going to remember what? Hypoglossal nerve. All right, so if you use these mnemonics, it will be a little bit easier for you to remember these things. All right, and then your book will have a whole list of various functions, but these are the only functions that I want you to know for these cranial nerves. But if you, when you get into nursing school or other kinds of clinical schools, you'll have to know many more functions for all of these cranial nerves, and for sure know the names and the numbers as well. Okay, but this is a good place for you to start. Now, if you don't like this mnemonic and you don't like the one in the book and you don't have time to make up your own, you can always go to medicalmnemonics.com, and you can use this site for looking at mnemonics for chemistry or anatomy, biology. Sometimes you have to memorize a whole bunch of different phyla information or genera, different things like that, but you can go to here. But I want you to filter out these mnemonics and filter out the X-rated ones, okay? Because I'm really shocked when I hear these really nasty X-rated mnemonics out in the hallways or in anatomy lab, right? So don't use the X-rated ones from this site right here, okay? All right, so, okay. So number 8, vestibulocochlear. Okay, where's that in the mnemonic right here? What's vestibulocochlear? It's number 8. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. I see an and. What did I say? It's the first letter should correspond to the first letter of the nerve. All right, but what's the first letter of vestibulocochlear? V. And what's the first letter in and? A. No one caught that one yet. Why is that? Okay, it's not because A is really an upside down V. That could be one way to look at it. But because it used to be called the auditory nerve, which is an important nerve for hearing. But we've simplified it. Instead of calling it auditory, we call it vestibulocochlear. Vestibulocochlear. Because when we get to senses, we're going to see that there is a cochlear part of the ear and a vestibular part for different kinds of senses. Right? So I wanted to point that out to you. Vestibular part for balance and the cochlear part for hearing. Has anyone ever heard of cochlear implants and what do they allow you to do? They allow a person to hear who has a damaged part of their ear. Right? So cochlea has to do with hearing. Vestibular part has to do with balance, all right? And even though it's an and right here. All right, so some of these nerves are motor, some are mixed, and some are sensory, okay? And so I do want you to know which ones are which. And so what do we want to use? Another mnemonic to help you know which nerves are purely sensory, which ones are purely motor, and which ones are mixed. And what does mixed mean? It has both afferent and afferent traffic. It's both sensory and motor, all put together. Okay, so here is a little key. If there's an S at the beginning of a word, it's going to be a purely sensory, or purely afferent nerve. If there's an M, it's going to be motor. And if there's a B right here, it's going to be both. It's going to have both sensory and motor traffic. So here's a little saying. Some say money matters, but my brother says big brains matter most. Okay? And you can find these things in medical mnemonics too. Or you could say big bucks, like money. Okay? A number of different ways you can remember that. So, cranial nerve, number 1, is some. What does that mean? It's purely sensory. Cranial nerve number 2, which is olfactory, is purely sensory. And cranial nerve number 3 is what? 100% motor. Right? So there's an easy way. You're not going to be walking around knowing exactly these nerves right here unless you're a neurologist, which ones are doing what. But if you're given 2 minutes, you can do what? You can figure it out. Okay? Just by using some of these mnemonics right here. All right, the other thing, I'm going to pull this slide back over here. All right, this is an exam figure for, not the test coming up, but the next one, but I just want you to know how easy it is to understand how these cranial nerves go. Like the first one from anterior is what? Number one. What's the second one? Number two. What's the third one? Number three. And then we got four. And then five. Okay, then six. Seven, eight. All right, so it's pretty easy to know the number. And then if you have your mnemonics, then you can then label this diagram pretty easily. All right, that's probably easier than trying to memorize all these names. First write the numbers down, and then use a mnemonic to write down what the name of that particular nerve is. Okay. Okay, so that's it for lecture today. We do have to finish some stuff up. We still got to look at some spinal. We've got just a little bit of things to talk about yet for peripheral, not too much. All right, so a week from today, we'll finish this lecture up. Because what is next time? Your lecture exam. And you need a picture ID for that, please. Today's quiz?
No,
oh,
quiz, yeah.
Oh, this week's quiz.
Yeah.
Sagittal brain. Just a brain. Which is? Chapter 13. I closed that. Did I close it already? Hold on. Maybe I can show you what picture it is. Oh, I closed it already. Yeah. Okay. Hi.
Show me where to find the five questions.